home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. This is Rob Watson and
Garrett Miller.
Oh my God, we have Blonde Jesus has made an appearance.
Are you ready?
I could go into a whole biblical analogy thing.
Oh my God, it's crazy.
Risen from the dead.
This is the first show we've been able to do together in like 5 months.
I know, it's crazy. And we have got quite the show tonight. I've got my very good friend and almost legendary journalist, Brody Levesque, who has been on top of every major LGBT story like forever. He's a top-notch journalist, covered the Washington, D.C. beat. He has been watching the Trump administration with eagle eyes and is going to give us all sorts of inside information on everything that's been going on.
Right on.
Yeah, we're going to hear stuff that most people won't even be aware of. So it's, you know, pretty exciting. But you finished out the year quite on top of everything with the Blonde Jesus getting major recognition.
Yeah, it's I'm so grateful. I just don't even know where to start. You know, from an indie album that's been out to get, you know, several, you know, I don't want to say top honors, but it's several top honors and with different. I mean, if it was just one place, you know, it was like Aunt Martha's sockhop.com or something, that'd be one thing, because, you know, you'd say,
well,
thanks,
she
Aunt
did
Martha.
Like it. She did like it.
That's true. But, you know, several different organizations were very, very generous to me. And I finished out the year with Blonde Jesus is the number one song on numberonemusic.com. It's an online, you know, online radio type of format. And I'm very grateful for their continued. And I have no idea. You know, sometimes I can go, oh, I bet this is how kind of the charts work or this one. I don't have a clue. All I know is that they keep you know, they just keep sending me a note saying you're number one again this week. I'm like, okay, this is wonderful. And so I finished 60 consecutive weeks with some song from the album at number one on some chart for, you know, for 60 weeks in a row, which is kind of incredible. I wish the economic gain from it was, you know, as wonderful as you know, the 60 weeks, but you know, the word's getting out. So I'm very grateful. Everybody,
that's great. And you've got new music projects coming up, right?
I do. I've got several things that are coming up. I've got a new album. Again, it all takes money, so money is something that currently, you know, I have to pay rent and buy food, but it doesn't pay for new music projects. So if anybody out there is listening and they have a big checkbook and they'd like to write a big fat check, I will go ahead and take it. But I'm working on a new disco album. It's called, you know, I'm still playing along with the Blonde Jesus thing. So it's Blonde Jesus Disco Resurrection, because he's bringing disco back from the dead. But I'm working with some really big names from that era of the, you know, the early mid, you know, 70s, including
Sherry. Oh, I thought
Sherry
you meant the biblical
Supreme
era.
Yeah, Moses and the Supremes.
The disco
and, you know,
diva of aught five or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, but that's... You know, but that's it. So I've got things lined up, but I just have to save the money, get the money, and be financially capable of going back into the studio and paying to have it done. And we'll go from there. But I've got that with one of the other recognitions that I've got with the HNA Network, the Hottest New Artist Award for 2017. They're going to be doing a compilation for me. They're going to do something for me. We're still talking about the project, but my thinking is to do a remix project and have that go out. But now it's a matter of finding the right remixers who work on the beer budget and picking the right songs to go out. So, you know, I've got some cool things that are happening on that front. And then the book is coming out hopefully in a couple of weeks. I've got a note into the publisher. They just sent me back a note yesterday saying we'll let you know by Friday. And the sneak peeks that have been going out to, you know, for reviews, just so I could get, you know, some people to, you know, say some nice things for the book. They said, holy cow, I peed my pants. And it's not because they needed the pens. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out too.
Well, that's very good, because I'm going to have to leverage your experience there because my big news for this year, or my intention for this year, wait for it, I'm not going to write a book. I'm going to write two. So.
Okay. Get on it. Make it happen.
No, I'm clearing my deck. I have actually resigned as executive editor of the Goodman Project because I was spending so much during the week editing and doing other people's stuff. And I've cleared that off. So I am going to be writing a nonfiction book, compilation of my blogging work and my story integrated into one book. And I am writing a fiction book on the other one.
Wow. I love it. Well, you're a great writer. I know that the play that you, or it's a play or short story that you let me read a while back, kept me going until the very end. And I was like, oh my gosh, at the end. So it doesn't surprise me that you're doing this. You should.
Well, you are the only one who has ever read that. Well, that's not true. The theater group that rejected it also read it, but between you and them, you're the only ones that read that. So
right on. I love it. So, you know, you have to do something with that at some point, whether it's today or tomorrow or next year, but it's a great play.
Well, I probably will. I'll send it off to some people and see if they want to do something with it. So, but okay. Let's, you know, enough about us. Let's bring
on
our guest.
Right, we've got your fantastic guest, Brody. Brody and I are friends on Facebook, but I've never talked to him.
You are in for a treat. He will blow your socks off. So without much ado, Brody, welcome to the show.
Never. Good evening. How are you doing?
we're doing very good, and I have like this notebook full of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
okay.
let me start with the one we haven't talked about at all. Joe Biden got a very nice surprise today. That was very moving.
It was very moving, and it was well within keeping of the president and the way that he has conducted his presidency and the way that he conducts almost every aspect of his life. I've known the VP since he was a United States Senator from Delaware. I think a lot of the Vice President and Dr. Biden, they're just, I can't say enough kind things about either of them. I was acquainted with their son, the former Attorney General of Delaware, who sadly passed away. Both was good people. But what happened today was that the president, and again, in keeping, and they kept it quiet, brought the Biden family, including the vice president, into the East Room of the White House. And then without telling the vice president, he awarded him with the United States' highest civilian honor, which is, of course, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The difference being, like three of his predecessors, he did a special designation, which he has not done in his presidency, and again, has only been done once before, three times. It's a medal with distinction. Pope John Paul was awarded that. Former President Reagan was awarded that, and former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell. So the Vice President joins a rather select group. And true to form, when the military aides came up and the young Marine captain, of course, was holding the medal, the vice president saw that and turned around his back to the audience and grabbed his hanky. And it was a very emotional thing.
I have a question for you on that. How did he know that that was going to be for him? Because he didn't know up to that moment. Was it just because he was the only one on stage, so he knew that?
He didn't know. See, that was the whole thing, and that was the fun part. He honestly, truly didn't know until the president turned around and said, and as he started to turn away, he could see the military aide coming with the medal. So it was just, and again, this is well within keeping for Vice President Biden. When you talk about certain people in Washington and even outside of Washington that are really the salt of the earth, I would put the Vice President of the United States and his lovely wife, Dr. Jill Biden, right in there with the best of them. He's an incredible, incredible human being.
Well, you know, I have to tell you the one thing, and Garrett, if you haven't seen the video, you should check it out because it's really emotional.
I'm on
Obama. Yeah, it's super, super cool. But the one thing, Brody, that surprised me a little bit, and in fact, I may even write about this, in the verbiage that Obama read and that was read in the proclamation of Joe Biden, the one area that was missing that I would have thrown in there was, you know, breaking the ceiling on LGBTQ rights. I mean, Joe Biden is the one that really did it. And
well, here's the thing. The vice president has been an integral part of doing things within the administration. And really, honestly, it is true that he's probably the first vice president in U.S. history that has been able to carry out the tasks that he has in the name of the president with a pretty heavy schedule. And, you know, the vice president's agenda has been full of things for the administration. Most of us in the Washington press corps, and you're talking relating the incident about marriage equality, that's in keeping with the vice president. That was a very much off-the-cuff remark. Unfortunately, it became a matter of, well, is this now going to be policy? And it did force the president's hand. But what most people don't know is that the president was already, as he's even said, evolving on the issue. If you remember, he did an interview with ABC News literally a couple of days after the vice president made his statements in public, where he announced his support. The thing about it is that the vice president has always been a staunch defender of the underdog. I mean, the vice president literally defends the least of these. So it's not that he's being slighted at all by that not being mentioned, because if you look at a broader picture of his role in that administration, then the citation that was read absolutely fits the description of what the vice president has done, not just for this administration, Rob, but also for the last 50 years that the man has been in government service.
Right. Yeah. And no, and bear in mind, I'm not nitpicking at it. It's like, you know, this wonderful thing and kind of going, oh, you forgot the yellow. It's like, where's the yellow? No. So, I get it, but it is the one area that, you know, of everybody who said, well, Joe Biden was the first. Joe Biden was the first. So anyway, let's shift gears a little bit, because Brody, you've been around more than a few years and had your share of press conferences. Give us, and I'm going to ask this with a straight face, give us your assessment of the Trump's first press conference. How'd that go for you?
It concerns me greatly. This man represents a clear and present danger to the First Amendment and freedom of the press and freedom of speech than has ever occurred before in the history of the American nation. And I don't say that lightly. The fact that his staff, after the fact, also eviscerated, and I know Jim Acosta. I'm acquainted. I'm not, you know, good friends with him, but I know Jim. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. His integrity as a journalist is beyond reproach.
Now, Jim is the CNN reporter?
He is CNN's chief White House reporter, or chief political reporter, yes.
Okay, so you might want to explain for people who don't know what happened with him at the conference.
Well, Jim had gone to ask a question, and the president-elect of the United States launched a tirade and basically said, you know, you're fake news. I'm not going to talk to you, you people. He just launched a tirade, and then he turned right around, and he called on a reporter from Breitbart.com, which is an uber-right, mega conservative, quite frankly bordering on white nationalist advocacy website. And that was rather telling. And then, of course, Sean Spicer, the incoming press secretary, also attempted to make noise about, you know, he threatened to basically say, look, we're going to take and, you know, throw this guy out. I mean, there are times that, you know, you've got there are times where I'm sure that those of us in the press corps annoy the press secretaries, and I think that, you know, even the current press secretary would probably agree with that. But we don't take it to the stage of we're going to censor the press. We don't take it to the stage where we're going to throw reporters out, and we certainly don't, you know, launch tirades. I think it's very telling the difference between the outgoing president of the United States, even President Bush, President Clinton, President Reagan, first President Bush, President Carter. You know, the last time I've seen anything remotely resembling this was when I was a teenager watching President Richard Nixon at a press conference with the White House, you know, press corps of that era. I don't even think Nixon, you know, had that much hostility leveled. So, I reiterate, this man represents a very clear and present danger to the First Amendment, the press freedoms of not only the press corps, but the American people.
And the comments that he made, apart from his treatment of the press, which I agree with you is scary, the level of misinformation that he put out based on the fact check afterwards, is that typical, unprecedented? What, I mean, where is that falling in terms of past presidents? And
I mean, looking at, and, you know, the Obama administration represents, you know, five White Houses for me in terms of, you know, covering the various administrations and, you know, the comings and goings in Washington. But Trump is not anywhere even close to the conventional role of a president elect, and I fear as a president. You know, there are certain conventions in Washington that, why they're not codified into law, they're still practiced, and it's a matter of, I guess you could call it niceties, and it's understandings and things like that. For example, our presence in the West Wing. There's nothing at all to keep us in the West Wing or the broadcast crews out on Pebble Beach, which is what we refer to the area out on the lawn in front of the West Wing entrance. And if the Trump administration decided to, they could throw us all out and we'd have to cover from outside that fence. You know, these conventions and social niceties are just things that have been going back and forth, and it's been an accepted standard. This administration coming in doesn't seem to care. The other problem is, and I'll say this quite frankly, this administration coming in not only doesn't only play fast and loose with facts, this administration, I don't believe, even knows what facts are to begin with. They certainly don't seem capable of telling the truth.
Right, right. Well, for example, he went into a thing about the joblessness in the country, and there's some articles out about it, and exaggerated by about 82 I think million people, figures. I mean, it wasn't even, you know, there's stretching the truth and then there's fiction. And, you know, that's kind of where it went.
You can label it. I think you can label it fiction if you'd like. The problem that I have with it as a journalist is that how are we supposed to be able to do our jobs as reporters and relay factual information for our viewers, readers, listeners to be able to make determinations that affect them in their personal lives when the people that are allegedly in the public service are liars?
Speaking of people, I was going to say speaking of liars, but I think I'll go the high road. Speaking of people in public service, we have got all the confirmation hearings going where people are telling their side of themselves and presenting themselves. Let's start with Jeff Sessions, because you had some discussions this week with, among other people, Judy Shepard, the mother of Matthew Shepard. What are your thoughts and impressions?
The problem with Sessions, again, in 1986, the widow of Martin Luther King had sent a letter to the then Judiciary Senate Committee, basically arguing that Sessions had no business being a federal judge, because this is a guy that came from the same school of thought of using police dogs and fire hoses on people versus, you know, enforcing civil rights, and that he could not be trusted with federal judgeship. We find ourselves 30-odd years later basically in the same boat. And it's not just, he signaled that he disagrees with the outgoing administration on policy, for example, in the broader criminal justice reform movement. That's very, very, very disconcerting, especially when you look at sentencing and police oversight. As you know, the American judicial system is weighted down by almost a sense of built-in racism. It's disproportionate in its application, and particularly with the African-American population. You know, the rate of incarceration for African-Americans is roughly double that of whites or Latinos. You know, police oversight. Sessions doesn't seem to have a problem with police departments that run around, you know, shooting unarmed black men. And that's kind of a big problem for those communities that are affected by cops that are gun happy. You know, and I know a lot of your listeners are probably going to be offended by my, you know, characterization of that. But, you know, I've seen enough in the last year alone that I feel comfortable in saying, yeah, they're gun happy. The other problem with Sessions is, as you know, he fought against the hate crimes legislation, the Shepard-Byrd's Act. Okay. If it wasn't for the fact that Senator Kennedy, who was still alive at the point, made a deal with Senator Hatch of Utah, and they literally basically piggybacked the legislation to the National Defense Authorization, you know, Sessions was one of the senators that kept shooting it down. Sessions has a miserable track record on civil rights. You know, he sits there and, you know, as a United States attorney, he essentially went after to restrict voting rights. And you know, I could go on and on and on, but there's no point to it. You know, Sessions is just a really bad idea. He also, you know, when it comes down to the LGBTQI community, yeah, this guy's no good. You know, it's that simple. All right, if we're going to go into the cabinet, Rob, we might as well look at today's, you know, actions. The Defense Secretary, former Marine General James Mattis, evaded all questions on whether or not, okay, the LGBTQI community should be allowed to serve. I mean, he basically shuffled that one off, okay, and said that at this point, okay, he wasn't making any decisions on policy unless a service chief came to him. When it talks about women in combat, you know, his direct quote to the question was, I'm looking for military residents. Then he added that he had no plan to oppose, you know, women. You know, Senator Gillibrand in New York, of course, then went, do you believe that openly serving homosexuals along with women in combat units is undermining our force? And, of course, he did the little shuffle dance. You know, on the other side, we're in another confirmation, you know, you had Ben Carson, who basically sat there and said, you know, that he was going to uphold the laws of the land. But when Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio pressed him on whether he would enforce LGBT protections in the public housing sector, Dr. Carson's response was, of course, I would enforce all laws of the land. Of course, I think all Americans should be protected by law. What I have said before is that I don't think anyone should get extra rights, he added. Now, if you'll remember, okay, those remarks are the same as what he made at the conservative PAC speech he made back in 2014. And I quote, of course, gay people should have the same rights as everyone else. They don't get extra rights. All right. Let's talk about Betty DeVos, Trump's, you know, pick for educational secretary. Right. This is a woman who has absolutely no problem, okay, upholding something that Jerry Falwell really wanted to do years and years ago. If you'll remember, in 1979, Falwell made a public statement where he said, I would just assume that the country returned to the way it was. There were no public schools and the Christians took care of education. Okay. This is the type of thinking that this woman comes from. She is also very much anti-LGBT, and she has dumped boatloads of money into campaigns, okay, with GOP senators and others who are, of course, you know, anti-gay. So, you know, you look at some of Trump's other picks, former Senator Dan Coats of Indiana, who Trump is slated to become the National Intelligence Director. This guy is also very anti-gay, and he's in keeping with, you know, former governor of Indiana and, of course, the vice president-elect of the United States, Mike Pence, who does not like our community. And, of course, we all remember, you know, what happened when he did the religious freedom legislation in Indiana, which, by the way, tangential to that fact, your listeners should be aware that we have 22 separate pieces of legislation almost identical to that Indiana legislation that is looking at being put on the books if these state legislatures okay, can get away with it, not to mention the bathroom bill issues going on in Texas, for example. And, of course, you know, today, Delegate Bob Marshall of Prince William County in Virginia introduced the Virginia version, which is even more onerous, believe it or not, than the North Carolina version. So this is just kind of an eyeball sketch at some of your feature attractions coming. If you want to leave the theater and not watch the rest of the trailer, I'll happily follow you out.
Right, right. So I wanted to ask you, though, because Peter Thiel, who is, you know, and I'm not holding up to any, you know, high level of, you know, admiration or anything like that, but he is the CEO of PayPal, and he is on Trump's transition team, and he's openly gay. There was an article out about him where he was basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing and taking my impression of, because he was being asked about basically, hello, look at this band of basically homophobes. Doesn't that bother you at all? And his comment was kind of indicated, you know, Trump's not anti-gay at all. And yeah, we've got this boatload, but they're all going to be muzzled. They're not going to get to be as anti-gay as they want to be because he's not, is kind of his comeback on that. What is your thoughts on that possibility? I'm not asking you the likelihood that he's right, but what, you know, is that possibly going to happen? Or
three words: it's not credible.
Okay.
If Thiel thinks, you know, and again, this is the same arguments that we've heard from log cabin Republicans. These are the same arguments that I'm sure your listeners have heard if they have any gay Republican friends. All right. That, oh, no, the president-elect is, you know, he's okay with the gay community and et cetera. I'm sorry. That's just not the case. You have to look at the total picture here. The emperor himself may not have any clothes. I wouldn't worry about the emperor. I'd be more concerned about his, you know, entourage and his courtiers, which in this case, a lot of these people are in bed with the far Christian right that obviously, and these so-called family values organizations that don't like the LGBTQI community and right now have put the trans community at the tip of the spear. So, no, it's not credible.
Right. So do you think when because obviously everybody's saying things that are at least subterfuge that nobody's putting out there, you know, brandishing an anti-gay, you know, agenda up front. They're either, you know, not addressing it or, you know, just sidestepping it. They are all likely to, I mean, it's a done deal. They're going to be in the positions that they're slated for. Are we going to be the first targets, or are they going to go after some of other Trump's other, you know, sacred cows that he got elected on?
I think that it's going to be a political potpourri when it comes down to what they're doing. I mean, as evidenced by the vote that was taken last night by the Senate in the first steps towards the bill resolution that, of course, will destroy, you know, the Affordable Care Act. You have to understand that Washington is a little polarized in two different directions. You've got one end of Pennsylvania Avenue. It's got one set of agenda and values, and this is even true of a same party hold on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue. And then you've got the House and the Senate, which has got, you know, their own. For the Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill, the biggest target for them is the Affordable Care Act. That's the big kahuna. That's what they want. The Trump administration coming in is a hot mess. I think that they really are showing that they don't have a good definition of what it is that they want to do. Mind you, this is an administration. I had a White House official tell me that during the first meeting between the president-elect and the president of the United States, the staffers were doing the meet and greet and get to know each other. And the incoming Trump staffers were in a state of shock because they didn't realize that everybody sitting at all those desks and wait in the West Wing, they were going to have to replace with a body. They didn't realize that. They thought that they inherited the whole mess, okay? So there's a sense of real amateur cluelessness that goes with this. Now, I'm not downplaying the fact that they aren't dangerous. They are. Okay. They definitely have an agenda. It's just that I think that, unfortunately, the Muslim American community, the Muslim community, the LGBTQI community, the women and women's reproductive rights and women's rights are all going to be dragged along, if you will, into this really unhealthy political roller coaster where it all gets caught up in the two agendas, both the Hills and the White House. The problem with the White House is that I don't think that they have a basic understanding of how government actually does work. And that's really where you're going to have some serious problems coming into it. And as evidenced by his public comments and the fact that he's just quite frankly clueless, I don't think the president-elect is going to be able to drive the agenda, at least in terms of legislative efforts. I think that's going to come from Capitol Hill. Now, right. as far as the Republicans on the Hill go, again, they've got one focus right now, and that's, you know, we want to take care of getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. Now, they've done some rather onerous things that are in and aside to that, in rules committees and things like that, that are going to spell trouble down the road, at least in terms of federal regulations, federal oversight, when it comes down to the various departments trying to do their jobs, and that includes agencies. I wrote a piece at the beginning of the week. I'm going to talk about the Rules Committee and some of the things that happened on Tuesday as the 115th Congress started to seat. One of the rules that was proposed by Republican Congressman Robert Bishop of Utah, who's chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, basically codifies any legislation to dispose of federal land or natural resources would have a net sum zero cost to taxpayers. So essentially what that means is it used to be, under the guidelines and the rules from the Congressional Budget Office, that any legislation that the House was going to put forward in the budgetary process that had to do with getting rid of surplus property or getting rid of federal property at all, they would have to have a discussion of cost, benefits, hearings, the whole nine yards, because they needed to render an assessment or cost analysis.
Right.
Well, this new House rule changes it to zero, so that means if they want to give the Pentagon away for a dollar, they can do it.
So there are things that, and
in the mainstream media, unfortunately, and I say that not unkindly, because for nearly 28 years of my career, I was part of the mainstream media, but yeah, it kind of slipped off their radar screen a little bit. All right. That means, for example, Rob, that national parks like Yosemite or even federal buildings and facilities in Washington, like the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover headquarters building, could literally all be given away without consideration of cost to the American taxpayer.
Right. So I have a question about a lot of the stuff that is happening so fast. That Obamacare, you know, there was all this discussion about, well, you know, they have to, you know, they're half the Republicans don't really want to just throw it out until they have another plan. And, you know, there are some that are just saying, get rid of it. And, you know, don't worry about that. And it seems like it is happening more that way, that they're just getting rid of it without a plan, which is going to send like a million people or more into turmoil with no health care.
That's true.
Bigger problem is this whirlwind of all this stuff happening. You know, I talk to people about these issues, and a lot of people are just sort of like, I mean, it's literally like too much for them. I mean, they're like signing out. They cannot get outraged because there's too many things coming at them at once. And then we get the major PR distractions, like, you know, Donald Trump doing water sports in Russia, and, you know, Meryl Streep going after, you know, Trump, and, oh, mean rich white woman is, you know, beating up on our, you know, anti-establishment boy. And, you know, isn't that awful? And all these things are making everything very noisy. And the things that I think could really impact people long term are boring, procedural, you know, oh, they did that, and nobody is getting upset over it.
Let me be perfectly transparent. Let me be perfectly clear. My profession.
As opposed to how you normally are?
Well, this is true, too. My profession is completely and utterly at fault in the execution of our job to keep the public informed. Those distractions that you just mentioned should be on page A31, not page right. A1 above the fold. I fault my profession for not doing its job. The number one responsibility of a journalist is to be able to tell a story that has an impact on a group or select groups of people. We're not doing our jobs, Rob. And
right.
I am, you know, and I don't care how many of my colleagues get upset and send me hate mail tomorrow, but we are at fault. We are at fault because the issues that really matter are not getting covered because there's this glorification and distraction process going on that's quite frankly ridiculous. You know, if someone wants to talk about an unsubstantiated dossier, okay, on the on the reality star that unfortunately is now the president-elect of the United States, then fine. Okay, why don't we have Entertainment Tonight or a suitable outlet do that? Okay, like that would be fine. I like TMZ, perfect outlet. But let's not have that discussion on the front page of the Washington Post. Let's not have that front page discussion happening on NBC, CBS, CNN. Let's talk about things that are going to affect American people, that are going to affect the voters. Let's not talk about distractions. And this really, quite frankly, is the fault of the press. And look, I've been a reporter for damn near 40 years. And I have to tell you, I am not terribly thrilled with that, and especially not in light of the fact that we have an administration coming in that is so nakedly hostile against the press, and we should be pushing back, and we're not even doing that. So
right.
you're talking
right.
about distractions. I'm telling you that's the fault of the press. I see that smaller media operations are starting to pick up the slack. And believe it or not, some excellent, excellent journalism is being done by some nonprofits in the places that you would least expect. Let me please cite and throw accolades out to the Center for American Progress for their vocal, well-funded, well-written, informative Think Progress. Because if it wasn't for them, a lot of the stuff would get dropped. And I'll give them credit for that. Let's talk about the people for the American Way's Right Wing Watch, okay? And I know the crew over at Right Wing Watch. They do an excellent job. So it's there are people that are trying to do the job, but unfortunately there's not enough of my colleagues that are doing it. And anytime, okay, we spend one drop of ink or 1 second of video or audio on something stupid like golden showers, we've just screwed up.
So let me ask you a question about that, though, because I hear you. I totally agree with you. The one thing that I would say, maybe, you know, stepping into the slightly bigger picture on it,
mm-hmm.
it used to be that journalism was being threatened by commercialism, by, you know, on TV, you know, news shows were getting more commercial. They had to, you know, lead with the, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, that it was starting to be manipulated by the things that were going to get the higher ratings. It was about the ratings, and you know that was starting to bastardize pure play journalism. We're now
mm-hmm.
in the social media age, and
sure.
you know, for all of his horrible faults, all of them, the one that Donald Trump is probably a genius at is social media, and you know, getting attention and playing the you know clickbait, if you will, concept. And
I know where you're going with this, and
let me get there first,
okay.
before you answer. So
Garrett's sitting on the sidelines going, I guess I'll just sit back and let you go ahead.
Well, this is fascinating, but the only comment that I had was about the, you know, the journalism or the quote unquote journalism from, you know, that we used to read, and Rob and I have talked about this before on the show 100 years ago, is the fact that, you know, I so want to read a CNN.com. I don't really have TV, so I really want to read a USA Today. I want to see CNN. I want to see a Huffington Post. I want to see a Yahoo. And for whatever good or bad you think of them, all mm-hmm. of them are guilty of, Rob lost 20 pounds. Look what he looks like now. You know, it's like,
right.
It's all journalism by, you know, you were talking about if it bleeds, it leads. It's now, if it's like, it's all the click-through rates. It's like, how many clicks can we get on this? And that just pisses me off because I don't want to hear an opinion in a story. If I want, then give me an op-ed or something like that. But when I'm going on any type of news, quote-unquote news source, and I'm just throwing CNN, USA Today, that type of thing under the bus here, I don't want to see your opinion in a headline, you know, mm-hmm. jaw-breaking whatever, dun-da-dun-da-da. Do a fucking headline and give us real news.
Rob was going there with it. It's the social media, Garrett, and there's two parts to it. Okay, and let's leave the president-elect out of this for a second. The answer to Rob's question, which I know where he was going because he and I are good enough friends, I knew we were set in with this. Let me answer it. There's two problems here. My profession has become part of the world's oldest profession.
Sure.
Okay, we are prostituting ourselves, okay? It's that simple. But what we're prostituting ourselves for, besides the clickbait, okay, is kind of this money issue and this whole process. Okay, of being out there first. When I first started as a journalist, Garrett, I had a reporter's notebook in my hip pocket. I had a pocket full of dimes, and like my colleagues, we would bust ass for the payphones and call in our stories to the copy editors. Okay,
now, like a real journalist.
I am a real journalist.
Right.
On my hip, I carry an iPhone. I can now record an interview, frame it, write around it, and I've done this, okay, and then I can file a story from my phone. Now, mm-hmm. let me tell you why that's important. When we saw the advent of cable news and when Mr. Turner basically created the foundations for what is now today's media, there were some smart executives in the big networks who suddenly realized that this was going to go a completely different way. In the late winter of 1993, after the launch of the World Wide Web, there was a series of conferences with journalists, and I was lucky to attend one of them. And we realized that the web was going to be the next generation. We had already seen, because of CNN, the 24/7 news cycle, as evidenced, if you will remember, during the first Bush administration, by the Iraqi campaign that basically rolled the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And during that time period, I think that most of us saw which way this was going to go. When cell phones were something that suddenly went from being an accessory to a necessity, and then they in turn, because of technology, became what they are now, again, there became an evolution in the news coverage. I think that the big part of the problem here, and this does have to do with social media too, is when you start adding on things like Facebook, you start adding on things like Twitter, it's a technology-driven thing that my profession has not been able to, I don't think, substantially get a real handle on how to effectively get the word out. One of the things that we discovered, I was the Washington bureau chief for a number of years for LGBTQ Nation magazine up until June of 2015 when the magazine was purchased by the Queerty Group out of San Francisco. But the founding publisher and editor and myself, both old school journalists, realized that there was going to be a need for good journalism that had to dovetail yet not echo 140 characters or a 30-second soundbite. We still mm-hmm. believe there's room for that. The whole thing is, Garrett and Rob, that it's still a race. Okay, for what's going to be the most ink. And again, I do honestly feel that it is a prostitution of the profession. And I think in a lot of ways, Garrett, you're right. Rob and I have talked about this. Yeah, it's very much financially true.
There's another point I actually wanted to ask you about that you may not know that where I'm going. So let me take it one step further. Because one thing, you mentioned LGBTQ Nation, which was mm-hmm. under you, was a great publication. And you guys, when you put out the stories that were hardcore journalism, you guys got the clicks. I mean, you made it. I mean, you were passed around like crazy, much better than the current version is, I might add. But like we were talking about Ben Carson, right now, news is driven by trending lists on Google, on Twitter. It's like, you know, something happens and it becomes a popularity contest. Meryl Streep goes right to the top because it's like it's sensational and boom, you know, Golden Showers goes right to the top, whether it deserves to or not, because it's being driven by public clicks. Like we were talking about Ben Carson. Ben Carson represents so many threats that are worth reading about that would upset people if they understood them. But he was trending today not because of that. You know why he was trending today? Because he made a stupid slip of the tongue with Elizabeth Warren when she said she was asking about Trump and sort of would he do favoritism for it. And he said, you know, I don't plan to do anything that will benefit any American, which is like came out exactly stupid. You know, it was a stupid thing to say. And it wasn't what he meant, but that is what trended. That's what everybody wanted to read about and make fun of and share about and everything else. And my fear is that system has taken control, and the journalists, to your point, Brody, that's what the journalists don't get. They are not jumping in and going, we need to own the conversation. They're letting the conversation and the meme quotes drive everything. And Trump knows that. Because that's all he does.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I would also have to split the fault with the editors, the publishers, and, of course, the owners of the media groups and the media outlets to do that, and that includes the web-based operations. It is extremely difficult in many cases, and this has always been a driving factor for a lot of these operations, to make money in the digital world. They haven't quite figured out how to do it. There's a little bit of schizophrenia, at least with the owners of the media companies in my profession, particularly if you're talking about newspapers, as to where to split the difference. Because the traditional economic model for, say, the Washington Post as a print or the WashingtonPost.com doesn't mesh with reality. And what does mesh with reality, as you so adroitly just pointed out, is that you're looking at the click-throughs and things like that. This is one of the problems that, taking it back to my earlier statements about the incoming Trump administration, is going to play havoc with the American public, because the American public is going to be so ill-informed. They're not going to understand. We had incidences where people were just railing about how bad Obamacare was, but yet they were covered under the Affordable Care Act. These people not understanding that they're the same thing. Okay. So to your point, yes, you're absolutely correct. Going back to what Garrett said earlier, I think that one of the things that we do need to understand is that one of the places that we have fallen down on is this is our responsibility, I think, as journalists. We don't educate anymore. All right? We're not informing our viewers, our readers, our listeners. This is not something that I am terribly proud of in my profession, and I've got to be honest. I think that it is incumbent upon old fossils, you know, those of us that have been in the job doing this for a while, that we've got to think about retraining and re-entrenching the younger ones so that they understand, hey, guys, this isn't about a Twitter. This isn't about a trend. This is about making sure you're absolutely crystal clear. Yeah, Garrett made the point about the headlines. I'll be honest with you, Garrett. In many cases, even with my current job, and I'm the chief political correspondent for the New Civil Rights, which is a fine little web magazine. I have a lot of respect for the owner and publisher. He's a dear friend. But I've given him artistic license on the headlines because I understand he's got to make money, and the only way he's going to get money into his pocket is if some of his headlines are quite frankly salacious enough that somebody's going to click on them. Now, it could even be one of my pieces, okay? Now, am I being hypocritical? Yeah, maybe. But here's the thing. He does not edit my stuff. And if you read my stuff, I'm very much old school. And Rob, you've read my stuff. Garrett, I'm sure you're probably going to get off the air and start Googling me. Have fun, Garrett. There's pages of Google on me. But I mean, the thing of it is, is that I understand that, but I also understand that it is incumbent upon me as a journalist to inform the public. It is definitely incumbent upon me, all right, to keep the LGBTQI community well informed as to what's going on that's going to adversely affect them because, A, all right, I'm part of the tribe, if you will, and B, this is the niche of journalism that I have picked out for myself because, again, it's an underrepresented group. Now, I cover Muslims, I cover Latinos, I cover, you know, the African-American experience as well. But when it comes down to the LGBTQI community, particularly the trans community, okay, I'm a huge trans ally, and I just am absolutely distraught that they're back at the tip of the spear again, and it's inherently unfair, it's wrong, and my responsibility as a journalist is to cover those things.
Right. Brody, I want to ask you, because believe it or not, we're running out of time here, but I wanted to ask you, and this ties into that whole, you know, the Trump papers and the golden showers and all that stuff. The big point that's being missed, because it's mm-hmm. so salacious and so tacky and all that, and everybody's excited and making fun of it and everything else. But the real point is Trump's ties to the Russians, which he has denied.
Yes.
And I just put on the Evol Equal page yesterday a video of just like 2 years ago where Donald Trump was talking on video about his close friend, Vladimir Putin, and, you know, on, and then, you know, completely counter to the way he positions not knowing him and all this stuff today, which is like, okay, why are you lying so completely if there isn't truth to, you know, you having been set up by this guy? What is our danger there, in your opinion, with the Russians?
President Trump is Richard Nixon version 3.0. The man is simply incapable of telling the truth. He cannot do it. If anybody has any means of expectations of him telling the truth, yeah, forget it. Here's the threat and the danger. Vladimir Putin is a former KGB officer, a former Soviet apparatchik. He was handpicked by Boris Yeltsin. He's accumulated vast powers within his own party and within the Russian Federation as president. He represents a threat to world peace because he absolutely, in an end run, it looks like, wants to reconstitute the Soviet Empire. And part of his thinking has been putting troops in Chechnya, putting troops in Georgia, you know, going into, you know, a completely sovereign nation of Ukraine and invading and overtaking and stealing Crimea, putting Russian special force troops into eastern Ukraine, which have done little more than given the government of Peter Poroshenko massive headaches and mass casualties to the Ukrainian people. Putin is dangerous. Trump taking the position of, this is my good buddy, Uncle Volod, all right, not only sends the message that we condone that kind of crap, but if it comes down to push versus shove, and, you know, and it's very, very possible that we could see Russian tanks entering eastern Ukraine, does that mean the United States is going to step back and walk away from its obligations? Does that mean the United States is going to step back from NATO? Does that mean the United States is going to step back from its responsibilities as a world leader? The truth of the matter is it sure looks that way.
Well, it represents the danger. Donald Trump has already signaled that. I mean, he's already said, you know, we're not necessarily going to step in on NATO because unless the, you know, country in question is going to do something for us. And it's like, hello, these countries are poor. They're not, you know, they're not going to turn around and say, you know, here's oil, United States, go at it. Now come help us.
I think the biggest concern for most people is the fact that he is enabling a rogue state, which is the Russian Federation. All right. And this is going to be very problematic and quite frankly, very dangerous.
I guess that's what I asked, isn't it? Okay. So Brody, we're in our final 5 minutes. What haven't we talked about that we should cover here?
I think that this is, especially for your listenership in particular, I need to caution all of your listeners that it is incumbent upon you as members of the LGBTQI community to, number one, support each other, and number two, you must be aware, and number three, you've got to be able to resist. You've got to be able to stand up, speak out. You have to do more than just sit and say, well, you know, it doesn't directly affect me. Yeah, it does directly affect you. Your rights as an American citizen, your rights as a human being, your civil rights are in grave danger with this administration and with this Congress. You need to speak up, you need to educate yourself, and you need to pay attention.
Very good. Very good. So one thing that I want to emphasize for sort of segueing here, this Saturday on Out in Santa Cruz, my guest is going to be good friend of Brody Levesque's, actually, a young man named Alec Fisher. He is a filmmaker out of Minnesota. He made at 18, Garrett, get this. I mean, you and I are, you know, out there doing our projects and stuff. This guy started in high school doing like fantastic things. At 18, he made a documentary about the bullying that was taking place in Minnesota. And I have to tell you, if you watch it on YouTube, the first 5 minutes, I didn't get through the credits without completely bawling. I mean, it was like amazing and is amazing. And he is doing a new film. It is on Generation Q. So it is about the young whippersnappers out there, below 18-year-olds. Yeah, and how they are seeing the world, which is going to be very interesting in the age of Trump, you know, to understand what that all is about. So
I think in the age of Trump, you know, Alex and his generation are going to be carrying, you know, a tremendous amount of water for the community. And these kids are extremely articulate. They're extremely bright. And they're extremely highly motivated. And the best thing about this generation is that they are colorblind, they are gender blind, and they are willing to fight.
And you know what, Brody? I think they're in for a shock. I honestly do. I think that Trump is going to do to them what Reagan did to our generation, where, you know, we're walking along kind of going, oh, things are evolving, these are da-da-da. And then something like AIDS rears its head, and we go into shock over how absolutely obstructionist and awful the power structure actually is. And I think Donald Trump is going to be, I think he's going to anger them on a deeper level than they even know today. My prediction.
I would agree with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But anyway, we're going to talk to Alec. He is brilliant. He was on this show a week ago today. And so if you haven't heard that show, he and I had a fantastic conversation. And so we're going to continue that this Saturday. So that's what's going on. Garrett, what's coming up for you besides?
Well, tomorrow morning on the Friday dance party, as I lose my voice here, you know, I've talked so much in this episode. I've got a world premiere of Kelly's Lot. They have a brand new album. It's called Bitter Sweet. We're doing a world premiere. Hour number one is going to be kind of a retrospective of prior Kelly's Lot music. They're a great blues and jazz band that tours the country. And hour two, Kelly is going to join us for about 15, 20 minutes to talk about the new album and what's going on. And then we're going to play music for everybody. And that's live starting at 7 a.m. Pacific tomorrow morning, Friday.
Fantastic. Brody, thank you so much. As always, you're brilliant. And I can't even tell you how much
thank you, Brody.
You. You know, and Garrett, oh my God, I love doing our show together.
Yay!
Come back.
Yes.
Need you back every week.
Yeah, well, if I'm not working like tonight, I mean, I got up at 6 and I raced home. So here we go.
Yeah. So no, it was great. It was really, really fun.
Thank you, Brody. Sure appreciate you too.
So
no problem.
And you, our dear listeners, you've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back probably next week. And we're on Facebook on our Rated LGBT page. Join that page, join the community, join the conversation. We love having you, and we're out of here. Thanks
bye
for
bye.
Joining us.